Well, friends, in the last few days, there was a great historic event in Scotland. The Scots voted to not become independent from England. But it was a different story in America in 1776. On July 4th of that year, America declared independence from England. And the Declaration of Independence has become an iconic document in American history. And that document pronounces that all people have unalienable rights to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. The pursuit of happiness, seeking happiness, contentment, and satisfaction. So for human beings, happiness or contentment or satisfaction is considered a good thing, and the lack of happiness or satisfaction is considered bad. So a very frustrated Mick Jagger sang, "I can't get no satisfaction," though he tried many times. And friends, the book of Ecclesiastes deals with the issue of finding satisfaction. The preacher in Ecclesiastes has already concluded that everyday life as we see it, life under the sun, is meaningless. It's a vanity, with no more purpose than a puff of wind. No meaning, no satisfaction. Rather depressing, actually. But friends, of course, we do look for meaning, don't we? We seek meaning because even though we live our lives in this physical world under the sun, we have a desire for something much more in our hearts, in the very core of our being, because God has put eternity in our hearts, as we find in chapter 3. Friends, we're hardwired to seek meaning. So we do pursue happiness. Like Mick Jagger, we do want satisfaction. All people seek satisfaction. Friends, you and I, here in 2014, seek satisfaction. But where do humans seek this satisfaction? Well, in money. Our culture tells us that. It tells us that if only we have enough money, we'll be happy. Tats Lotto tells us that life could be a dream if we just pick the right numbers. And the more money, the better dream. The more fancy restaurants, the more overseas trips, the more upmarket neighbourhood. But friends, the idea that money brings satisfaction is not new. So in the 1960s musical Cabaret, they sang, "Money makes the world go round." In the 70s and 80s, ABBA sang about more money, money, money. Madonna sang that she's a material girl living in a material world. But the idea that money brings satisfaction goes back even further again, back to even when the book of Ecclesiastes was written. And we see that in chapter 5, which was read to us. This idea that money brings satisfaction is ingrained in culture. And the desire to get rich is self-focused and powerful. We're told over in chapter 4, verse 4, that all success in work comes from a man's envy of his neighbour. The desire to get rich doesn't mind if it walks over people. It avails itself of any and every opportunity. It's all-consuming. And those who seek to get rich do so at the expense of the poor. You know, the rich get richer and the poor get the picture. And this oppression of the poor by chasing money is not new. And friends, it's often systemic. And that's what we find in chapter 5, verse 8. So here there's racketeering going on within the government. The poor are being oppressed, their rights are violated, and it's happening right under the nose of the official. But the official doesn't intervene because he's watched by somebody over him, who in turn is watched by higher officials. They're all watching out for one another and watching over one another. They're looking to line their own pockets. And they're not protecting the interests of the poor. And friends, what's worse, the highest person in the government, the king, is in cahoots with them. We see that in chapter 5, verse 9. And the NIV translation here gives a better sense of what's going on. It says, the increase from the land is taken by all. The king himself profits from the fields. That is, the profits from the land are taken by all the officials, all corruptly looking out for one another. And this profiteering extends all the way to the king, the chief profiteer, and as usual, the poor suffer. But friends, what actually happens when someone eventually does become rich? Are they satisfied? Will all their work and rorting the system and walking over people in the process be worth it? Will they be satisfied with what they've got? After all, how much is enough? Well, the famous American oil tycoon J.D. Rockefeller answered that question more than 100 years ago. How much money is enough? Rockefeller said, just a little bit more. You see, those who love money, who spend all their time and effort scheming to get it, are never satisfied. So verse 10 of chapter 5 says, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. In fact, part of the reason that those who amass wealth are not satisfied is that their wealth actually complicates their lives. So if you get rich, there are new complexities. You might buy a mansion. Then you need a gardener to keep the grounds, and maids to clean the house, and a chauffeur to drive you places, and a nanny to care for your kids. And you need accountants and lawyers to protect your fortune, and an investment advisor to invest your money. So as your wealth increases, life gets complex. You need more and more people, all of whom you have to pay, to look after your affairs, which you didn't have to worry about when you were poor. But also when you get wealthy, you get more charities and hangers-on who knock on your door for more handouts, a bit like we read in verse 11. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? And all this money brings worry. So what happens if my investments crash? Or if my investment advisor siphons off my money to the Bahamas? Or if the tax office catches up with the dodgy accounting I used to get rich? And this worry makes it hard to sleep. Or if it's not the worry, perhaps it's the overindulgence, too much rich food and too little exercise. So unlike the labourer we see in verse 12, he's worn out by his repetitive physical work and sleeps soundly at night from his exhaustion, whether well-fed or not. Now, the desire to get rich is like an insatiable appetite. It can't be satisfied. There's always the desire to get more. There's never satisfaction with having the simple things in life. And we see that over in chapter 6, verse 7. All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. And here the appetite is not just for food. Here appetite refers also to desiring money and possessions. It's saying in different words what we saw in chapter 5, verse 10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. We're so easily dissatisfied with our lot in life, with what we have. We always want something more, something better. So a person might have a perfectly good smartphone, which works perfectly well, but then a new model comes out, like the iPhone 6, and people will queue for hours just to get one. Like on the news the other night, some people slept out for two nights, keeping their place in the queue, so they could get an iPhone first thing Friday morning. And I suppose, of course, that it will satisfy them, at least for a while until the next one arrives. Now, friends, Old Testament wisdom literature suggested that normally, and all things being equal, wise living would lead to prosperity, including financial prosperity. But if wealth means that those who get wealthy are never satisfied, chapter 6, verse 7, well, the wise, wealthy person is no better off than the fool, verse 8. Because if you're dissatisfied, it doesn't matter whether you're wise or foolish, you're still dissatisfied. So the wealthy are very often not satisfied. In fact, I don't know if you've noticed, but it's often the poorest who are easiest satisfied by simple things. So Samaritan's Purse distributes shoeboxes at Christmas to poor children in the developing world, a shoebox containing a relatively few simple items, many of them everyday items, certainly not what we'd call luxuries. And yet the kids, though poor, are overjoyed by a relatively modest gift. And verse 8 asks the question, what does the poor man have? Well, the poor live by the sight of their eyes, chapter 6, verse 9. They're content when their daily needs are met. They're not driven, verse 9, by the wandering of the appetite, because the wandering, unsatisfied desires of the wealthy are futile. They're like chasing after the wind. Well, friends, we've seen that there's no enduring satisfaction in money, which, of course, on the surface sounds a bit surprising. Perhaps you and I would have thought that money and wealth would have been sure to bring satisfaction and enjoyment. I mean, that's the whole point behind all the rags-to-riches stories we see in the movies or on the current affairs shows. People get rich, all their problems are solved, they live happily ever after. But of course, that's not usually the case. Sometimes, in fact, there are riches to rags stories. So some of you might remember Alan Bond. He went from being one of the richest men in Australia to being bankrupt to going to jail. Bond had it all and he lost it all. And we meet someone a bit like that in chapter 5, verse 13. The preacher describes this riches to rags story as a grievous evil. So here's a man, friend, who's hoarded his wealth. He's been slaving away, getting richer, and he's kept his wealth, verse 13. He's not shared it with anybody else. But then he sees an opportunity to make more money, maybe to double his money in some speculative venture. And so he invests everything and sits back to watch his fortune grow and take life easy. Maybe a bit like the rich fool in Luke chapter 12. But then he loses the lot. It's a bad venture, verse 14. And overnight he goes from being wealthy to not having a brass razoo. All the money he had is no good to him now because somebody else has got it and he's got nothing for himself. And he's got nothing to leave for his heir. He's the father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. And so now his life will be hard. His money's brought him no lasting satisfaction. He came into life penniless, and it looks like he's going out the same way. In financial terms, there's been no net gain for his life, toiling and scheming under the sun. And friends, tragically, in relational terms, the picture's the same. He's been so fixated on making money, which he hoarded to himself, that he's got no relationships to speak of. So no wonder in verse 17 that he eats in darkness and vexation and sickness and anger. Friends, he gave his life to money. Now he's lost it all and he's alone, friendless and frustrated with no satisfaction in life. But friends, even if you don't lose wealth through bad investments, there's still no guarantee that you'll be able to enjoy your money. In fact, in chapter 6, verse 1, we meet someone who's been given great wealth by God. He's got everything he desires, but somehow he lacks one thing, the ability to enjoy his wealth. Somehow God prevents him from finding satisfaction in his wealth. Perhaps he's so worried about safeguarding it that he can't enjoy it. Or perhaps he has some debilitating disease. So instead, a stranger enjoys his wealth. Verse 2. And according to the preacher, it's a shocking state of affairs. It's an evil, verse 1, or a grievous evil, verse 2. In fact, according to the preacher, in verses 3 to 6, if any person is greatly blessed by having an extraordinarily long life and fathering many children, yet if he doesn't find satisfaction in the good things of life, the preacher says he's no better off than a stillborn child. It's a grievous evil. Well, friends, together we've seen that there's no enduring satisfaction in money, and we've seen that according to the preacher, this is an evil thing, a great misfortune. Because you see, people devote so much time and effort in chasing money and often sacrifice relationships and health and ethics along the way. But it's worth asking the question, why doesn't money satisfy us? Why are the wealthiest people often the least satisfied in life? Why do some of the wealthiest people in show business have some of the saddest, most tragic personal lives? Well, friends, it's because they look to money to do something it was never meant to do, to be something it was never meant to be. Friends, we weren't made for money. We weren't made to find satisfaction in money. How could we be? God has put eternity in our hearts. So, friends, where will we find satisfaction? Well, we get a hint, don't we, in chapter 5, verse 18 to 19, where the preacher talks about what is good rather than what is evil. He writes, verse 18, "Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the joy, in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart." Friends, it really is possible to find satisfaction in life, not by making a god of our money or of our possessions or of work, but by recognizing that these things are gifts from the true God, by acknowledging God, the gift giver. We'll find satisfaction by pursuing him, not money. So according to chapter 5, verse 18 to 19, it's good to do useful, productive work. It's good to enjoy food and drink and material things. It's good because these things are good gifts from God, given for our enjoyment by God, not for our enslavement as little gods. And friends, when our attitude to these things is right, when we thankfully acknowledge that they come from God, God himself keeps us occupied with joy in our hearts. Friends, in order to know satisfaction in life, we need to know God the giver, the gift giver, and the giver of life. And when we do know God, well, in the words of 1 Timothy 6, verse 8, we'll be content with what we have. We won't wear ourselves out seeking satisfaction from money because we'll know that there's no ultimate satisfaction there. But those who love money don't know this. Their pursuit of wealth blinds them from seeing this. So according to 1 Timothy 6, verse 9, those who chase money actually end up harming themselves, like the man in Ecclesiastes 5, verse 13, who greedily kept his riches to his own hurt. According to 1 Timothy 5, 9 to 10, 6, 9 to 10, those who chase money cause themselves all sorts of problems because the love of money is a root of all kinds of evils. You see, a great trap with wealth is that it tricks people. Often, friends, if you're wealthy, you're tempted to think that you're better than everyone else, and you can end up being haughty, not wanting to associate with average people, or talking them down, or running roughshod over them, or foolishly believing you're master of your fate and captain of your soul. Being wealthy can breed a certain arrogance. So therefore, in verse 17 of 1 Timothy 6, Paul warns the wealthy not to be haughty and not to hope in uncertain riches, but to hope in God, the giver of all things, to generously share their wealth and do good to others with it, demonstrating that they're indeed placing their hope in God. Which takes us back to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. So Ecclesiastes 5, starting at verse 1. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. To draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they are doing evil. Be not rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God, for God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. For a dream comes with much business, and a fool's voice with many words. The emphasis here is on rightly relating to God, to remember that God is God and we're not, that God is not like one of our mates, that he's not the big fella upstairs who we'll have a game of golf with when we die. As humans, that we're made in God's image, he's not made in ours. The true God of the Bible, friends, is utterly holy, he's morally perfect, and we're not. So in the Old Testament, God regulated how his people could approach him in worship, in his temple, the house of God. And back then, if you went to the temple, the thing that really struck you was the presence of death. Animals were continually being slaughtered, and their blood offered, and their carcasses burned, as the means prescribed by God for people to have their sin covered so they could safely approach him in worship. So back then, you didn't come near to God's house, the temple, flippantly or casually. You came with animal sacrifice. You came reverently in awe, remembering who you were dealing with, the God of the universe. So in the words of Ecclesiastes 5 verse 1, if you were wise, you would guard your steps when you went to God's house. This one true and holy God, the giver of life and all good things, the only true source of satisfaction in life. Friends, money can never bring satisfaction in life. Only God can. God has put eternity in our hearts, so we do seek meaning and satisfaction. But friends, these things are truly only ultimately found in a relationship with God. Friends, in order to have true satisfaction in life, we must be connected to God. But friends, by nature, we're not connected to God. In fact, we're naturally disconnected by our sin. Like the people in the Old Testament who needed their sin covered by the gory temple sacrifices, we too need our sin dealt with if we're to know the true and deep satisfaction of being connected to God. And friends, the glorious, wonderful news is this. Jesus is the one who himself, though perfect, was sacrificed on the cross. He was sacrificed as the once-off permanent payment for sin of all who'll trust in him. So friends, my prayer this morning is that all of us here will truly be trusting in Jesus' astonishing sacrifice for the forgiveness of our sins. You see, if we are, then we are indeed connected to God permanently as his loved children. And as we get to know him better as our Father, we'll delightfully find that he is indeed the true source of satisfaction we desire, both now and for eternity.